I want you to have to guess the number.
Go ahead, Steve.
Is this okay? I'm Steve Hastings, and I'm going to talk very briefly about how to get cool stuff for free. Specifically today, useful software that the FFT would be involved with. And it's very faint because of the color, but my email address is steve@hastings.org. And if you want, you can send me email, but I get a lot of spam, and my spam filter might eat your email, for which I apologize in advance. So let's take a look. First of all, the Audacity audio editor. I do all of my audio editing in Audacity. I'm a software guy, not an audio guy as much, and it does everything I need. It's available for Windows, Mac, and Linux. It works the same on Windows, Mac, and Linux, which is a plus. I use all three of those, and I like having one audio editor. And if I had to pick one kind of interesting, cool feature of it, is you can use it to salvage corrupted WAV files. It has a raw import where you can tell it what kind of samples you think are probably in the WAV file and how many samples or how many bytes, whatever, to skip in, to skip over the corrupted header, and you can pull audio out. It's an audio editor. It looks about like you'd expect an audio editor to look like. You can get it by going to the audacity.sourceforge.net webpage. And the only confusing thing is it has two download links. So one says beta and the other one doesn't. Well, just take the beta. The beta is fine. The beta has been in beta for like 5 years now. So it's the one you want. The other one is getting long in the tooth, especially if you're using Windows 7. You want the beta. You don't want the old one. So that's Audacity. And Audacity, by the way, has a frequency plot that it will do, and that's based on the FFT. And it has a little drop-down where you can pick different window functions. So that might be a kind of a fun, quick demo that JJ can pull up because he's got Audacity on his laptop. Okay, he'll do that at lunch, he says. So the other thing is he's using software called Octave to do a lot of these plots and things. And Octave is just this all-around math package that is similar to MATLAB. The difference is that Octave is free software that is freely developed and you can get it for free, whereas MATLAB, they get you for $2,000 to $5,000, depending on what you're buying, and then they get you every year as often as they can. If you're a professional, you maybe already have a copy of MATLAB, and otherwise, if you want to play around with this stuff, Octave is definitely a good choice. So if you wanted, and actually, the number one reason you would want Octave is so you could run JJ's scripts that JJ wrote for you. He's going to demo these scripts, that's what this is going to, you're going to see this later. So if you want to be able to run JJ's scripts, you would want Octave for that. So the confusing thing about Octave is if you go to the Octave website, it has this downloading thing, and the top link, that's to the source code. Okay, the source code is interesting to me. I might actually build Octave, but you probably don't want the source code. You probably just want Octave. And they basically tell you to go to another site, and the other site is... the other site is called Octave Forge, but I guess the URL is octave.sourceforge.net. So if you go to Octave Forge, they have a download link for the Windows build and a download link for the Mac build. And if anybody out here knows what Cygwin is, you can get Octave through Cygwin. And if you don't even know what it is, never mind, you probably don't want it.
And if you miss all your Unix utilities, get Cygwin.
Yes, if you're a Unix fan and you wish Windows was more like Unix, then you want Cygwin. I don't use Windows without Cygwin. I've got to have it. Here's my last slide. Just keep in mind, there is a ton of cool free stuff out there. And you can find some with Google, and you can find some of it just by going like to Wikipedia. Here's the Wikipedia page, list of free software for audio. And there's a ton of stuff, including Audacity, and I'm not sure if they'd have Octave in this list, but there's a ton of stuff here. So that's my little quick that's the end of my deck. That's my quick introduction, and I'll be around if anybody wants to ask me any questions.
And you might want to mention that when you get Octave, you want to get a couple packages. You want to get the audio package. You want to get the signal package.
Sure. This is something I forgot to put in my presentation. JJ points out, when you get Octave, there's this base Octave system, and it's missing a lot of stuff. And because they just assume not everybody wants everything. And it's divided up into what they call packages. And if you want to play around with the FFT, you definitely want the Octave signal processing package. So when you get Octave from this site is also where you get all the packages. And again, if you're a Cygwin user, you get it through the Cygwin system, and you can just go in and not only check the box for Octave, but check all the boxes for Octave signal processing and Octave plotting, so it's modular, and it doesn't necessarily come with all the modules. And if you find you get Octave and it says like it doesn't know how to do an FFT, then just keep in mind you need to go get the extra modules.
The modules that I'm running here are the audio module, the signal processing module, and there was a linear algebra module I had to add, and if I remembered it, I'd tell you. But it comes out pretty obvious because they have a list of what functions are in what things, and when it says I can't find foo, you just look for foo and load that. And sometimes you find out when you click on one, it loads 8 other modules. You don't care. It'll just take care of it for you. Okay, now going back to... We are doing a Spectre and an Octave, the setup. Okay. Now I'm going to explain... Pardon me while I put my microphone back on. So that if I don't put it that way, I will kill myself in wires. Okay, so doing a Spectrum and Octave, there's two parts to it. There's a setup. I'm going to explain a little bit about how Octave works here. What you see here is these three magic incantations get rid of anything that might be in memory, in the Octave memory. You always just put that at the beginning of a script unless you're going to process something you deliberately left around. Because this is garbage collection. This is, you know, call it hygiene, you know. You want to set some link through the FFT. You can use another. You can use any power too. I just chose this one. I just told it the sampling rate. There's a when you do wave read, you can get the sampling rate out of wave read. But I was lazy and I knew this was a CD, so I just set up the sampling rate. When you're in Octave, you say help wave read. It will give you the manual page for wave read. So you can do that, find out how to get the sampling rate, the number of bits, and all that stuff. But the real purpose of wave read is to make you not have to do all that crap.
Why did they use the pound sign for comments rather than percent?
It's MATLAB. It's Fortran-based.
No, MATLAB is percent.
Well, there's a lot of things that...
So the answer is... Octave will do the percent for the comment, but it also does the sharp sign.
Yeah.
The sharp sign is traditional in the Unix world.
Yeah.
Everything, Perl, Python, Fortran shell, all those things all use the sharp for comment. And apparently sharp wasn't used for anything in MATLAB, so it was available. So Octave just works with sharp or percent for comments.
Which one uses both?
Octave uses both. Octave uses percent sign for comments or the sharp. MATLAB only uses percent.
Yeah, it made it hard. made it harder to import in MATLAB at all.
Sorry about that. You just take out all the comments if it bothers you. So what I do here is I set up a window. Now, conveniently, MATLAB has internally generated hand window. It doesn't actually have quite the hand window you want, but it's close enough. You set up the shift length as length over 2. Okay, wave read is the thing you get from the audio package. It reads a wave file and stuffs it into an array. Right now, wave read in the Octave thing only works for 1 and 2 channel wave files. There is
modifications to wave read and wave write that will do multi-channel wave files. I used to have them. I lost touch with them. I could probably find them again if I needed to, but I haven't, so I didn't, so I won't. And you can write a multi-channel wave file in Audacity if you have to. Here you get, you just pick up the file. This function, whos, tells you all the variables you have and the size. And I just put the I put that in there just so you can tell how big the file is. But what you do here is you take file length as the length of x. Length is a function that takes figures out the longest dimension of an array. You know, you can have any number of dimensions in an array in MATLAB. This just looks at all the dimensions and takes the longest one, and that's what length does. But this tells you how many samples long it is. Figure out how many blocks you can do. I might throw away the end of the file. Do I care? Well, if I was this is production code, I might care, but I don't care. Now, something you have to worry about is having zero blocks. You know, when you do things like take a log of zero, it gives you a headache. So don't do that. Length of spectrum is length over 2 plus 1. Remember that whole thing about how the spectrum works? This is figuring out the length of the spectrum. And then what I'm doing here is I put in, made a variable to hold on to the sum spectrum. And this, by the way, there's a thing called plot spec in the zip file. This is p spec by block is what you're looking at. There's also plot spec. And I'll run it in a minute, so you'll see what it does. Okay, the work for each block, okay, we're picking out this. This is just figuring out where the data is, picking up the block for the right channel. Basically, we sum the absolute value of the data. We do that to find out if there's any. If it's zero, it's digital zero, you don't care. So if it's digital zero, you just hide. And why this is less than 32768 is because I know this was 16 input stuff, and the way MATLAB, the way Octave reads it in float as plus and minus one is full scale. It doesn't read it in as integers, just so you have to remember that. So then here, what do? We have non-zero blocks. We for our average, we keep track of the non-zero blocks. We take it to transform. We take the sum, we do the other channel, and we plot it. And now what I've done, not in this one, but in the one I'm going to show you, down here, what I've done here is I've just asked for an input so I can make, you know, step it one block at a time. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to go over to this, and I'm going to run the script, and you can just see how it works. Where's my mouse? This. Okay. Oh. Okay, that's. Okay, now. Okay, I'm going to do PS. PC. PSpec by block. Now you see the .m file up there listed as the file name. What I'm doing is that makes it into a function, so now what I'm going to do by typing the function name, I get the function. I'm going to run the function. Now what it's going to do is it's going to read, anybody here familiar with Jethro Tull's Songs from the Wood? Well, it's going to, that's what we're taking the spectrum of here. So I tell it to go. It stops, it takes a little while to read the file because it sucks the whole file into memory. This is not good at streaming. Okay, now it said SS equals zero. You see over there, SS is the sum of both channels there. It says it's zero. Oh, look, it's a zero block. Forget it. We don't care about the zero blocks. And oh, look, not a zero block. Now, I got to go over here and move this over again. We have our spectrum. Move this down and cut. So see what we did here is we did this subplot. We basically plot In the first, what we did is we did both channels at once here is what we did. And what we do in the first plot is we plot the time waveform of the windowed signal. Second, when we're plotting the spectrum. And we can go down here. You notice, by the way, the sort of weird-looking spectrum here where this is rising at high frequencies? Well, that's because there's a great big discontinuity at the beginning. Discontinuities equals high frequencies. Something to remember about Fourier transforms is if you have a discontinuity in a signal, just a single discontinuity, like a square wave, it's going to roll off at 1 over f. If you have a discontinuity in the derivative, it's going to roll off at 1 over f squared and so on. That's why a square wave rolls off at 1 over f, is because it has a discontinuity in the derivative. If it has a discontinuity in the integral, which is, say, it's got an impulse in it, then it's going to have a flat spectrum. If it's got a doublet, it's going to have a rising by f and so on. That's just things you can guess a spectrum very often just by looking at things like that.
So, JJ.
Yeah?
The 2500 here and the 5000 flex spectrum.
This is lines. No, this is frequency. I did the, I sat down, let's see, where's the plot? No, I plotted, see, it's just plot and plot here. So what I'm doing is I'm not plotting frequency. I'm just plotting lines. You'd, at 2049 here would be corresponding to half the sampling rate. So some other ones I actually did convert into frequency. But see, you can do this. And you know, you can get it block by block if you want. If you're trying to, sometimes you're trying to find a glitch or something weird, just going through and then, you know, when you have a digital blip or something, you might go through and then you'll see something like this in one block. And that sort of like helps you find it.
For each of these one, I'm sorry, Jordan.
Yeah, go ahead.
Could you explain again how you sum the blocks, the spectrums from the blocks next to each other?
I'm not summing them here. This is per block.
Okay, so that's just the FFT result.
This is the power spectrum.
From that window.
From that, this is the window left and right. This is the power spectrum for left and right.
And
that's
how big
it.
Is that window?
The window is, I think, well, you can see it's 496. Okay. 496.
But you're just windowing each block.
Just windowing each block here.
But if it ends up starting in the middle of the block, then yeah. Of course it doesn't do you any good.
Yep. Now I'm going to quit out of this. And that error is to speak. Now I'm going to do something. I'm going to do spec plot. This is a different routine. This doesn't do it block by block. First thing that's going to happen is my plot spec. There's already something called spec plot, so I had to call it plot spec. It's going to erase that, and now it's going to take a little while. And then this is showing you all the non-zero blocks, and I'm going to show you the mean spectrum at the end of this. There we go. It's plotted it as usual. It comes over here, back where you belong. And now what you have is the mean spectrum of the left and the right. So here's the way I overlap this is I'm stepping by half a block. I'm using a hand window. So each sample is equally weighted. So that's how I'm doing the overlap here. And this is taking all the sum, this is taking the sum of energy of all of them, dividing it by the number of non-zero blocks. And then converting it to log into dB. And you can see all that code in the script if you want. So this is the kind of stuff you can do very quickly. And I mean, this is not something you'd probably use in a production tool, but for going and figuring out what in the heck is going on here, this can be really handy. Okay.
So.
Yeah. What? I can't hear you?
I'm trying to get there. So on the 1,000,
yeah,
is that like 10? Does that correspond to 10K, or is there?
No. This here is 2049 lines.
That define lines.
So 204, the 20 line is, you know, one bin in the spectrum. This is, there's 2049 bins in the spectrum because it's a 4096 point transform. Okay. Now 2049 constitutes half the sampling rate. So this line right here is 22050 hertz.
Okay.
So 1024 would be 1125. And obviously I could write a different axis here and you could just get frequency. And I apologize, but I didn't do that.
But the top octave is pretty much the last half of this.
The top octave is this is a linear in frequency. You could plot this. You could plot this as log. As
and
log
that's
frequency.
Why everything's clumped up at the beginning.
That's why everything's clumped up at the beginning, indeed.
This
yeah.
is all in high
and I'm just here. Since I'm showing the properties of FFT, which doesn't have a log frequency resolution, I'm showing the frequency linear. But you could just as well do a log frequency plot. It's built into the beast. You notice where I did semi log y. Semi-log y gives you log in this scale. Semi-log x gives you log in this scale. And there's log-log, which do log in both. And those are just automatics. So that's the kind of data you can get. Now, you can get these. You can get this stuff. You upload Octave. You can run it. You can make signals. There's a thing called wave write, which is exactly what it sounds like. You can generate some test signals and write them. And then... Sorry, little QRM here.
Download it for free.
You download it for free, and then you can read and write the WAVE files. I got these files by using EAC, which I think that's also on SourceForge, right? EAC?
Yeah, I'm not sure, but EAC is Exact Audio Copy. It's a tool for taking a CD and pulling audio off.
And if you have WAVE files from something else, you just use the WAVE files. The only thing you can't do is you can't use all super long WAVE files because the MATLAB sticks this all in memory, and unfortunately, it's still running in a 32-bit app. I think they'll get up to 64-bit eventually, but right now, its memory space is a bit limited. Of course, that's limited in terms of modern computers.
You guys ever use Scilab?
I have
similar to this.
I haven't, but we had some stuff like that a long time ago. But if I used it, I don't remember the name, and it was about about 1990, so I don't remember too clearly.
It's 64-bit too.
What?
Scilab has got a 64-bit build, so you can load.
That would be a good thing. Yes. Okay, something else you can do here. And this is a different thing. I'm not going to run the script for this. But what we're doing here is we're sucking in a WAVE file. We're figuring out the length. And we're taking a histogram of the bins. This is just taking -327.68 to +327.67. And it's looking at the histogram of the CD. How many times hit minus max? How many times hit plus max? How many times hit every level in the middle? And you find some scary stuff out there. Check it out. This is a ragtime piano thing that is obviously not using. Notice down here, this is what, it's not using very much of the dynamic range, and it's got a ton of missing codes. What happens here, since this picture isn't 65K wide, what it plots is it plots the maximum and minimum probability in each bin. So what you're seeing here is a signal that doesn't use all the dynamic range. It has a crap load of missing codes. And this, in fact, is a very, it's a recording of a guy made in his trailer, and the guy's a really good ragtime pianist, but don't talk about the recording quality. Over here, this is LYS, I think it is. It's some J-pop thing I got from my daughter. That's a phenomenal level of clipping, is all I can say.
And the center is zero crossing.
This is zero. You should see a peak at zero. What you should not see is a peak at plus and minus. You should see something that's more or less log normal, but you notice that this peak is at about, a 0.5, and this is about, there's about a difference in probability of about a factor of 3 between zero and maximum. And that's just a little bit of clipping. So this is something to look at. You look at CDs this way and you say, gee, I wonder what they're thinking when they made this. For the record, yes, this is blisteringly loud.
Do you have a sample of a picture of something that's well recorded?
There are stuff out on the net.
Yeah.
You know Photobucket?
Yeah.
I'm on photobucket.com. I'm JJ trip underscore 0001. I put a whole bunch up there.
JJ, and
what?
Question. Why is that filled in and this one not filled in?
Because this one has lots of missing codes. This base, anything that hits the bottom is a missing code in a bin. And this has no missing codes. So this has a ton of missing codes. This is a 16-bit recording that's about 11 bits. It's mostly missing codes. This is a 16-bit recording that's really got mostly three levels, which is just kind of wrong. But what?
3 bits.
Yeah, it's roughly 1.58 bits, but yes. No, three levels is 1.58 bits. But, you know, it's...
Did they use a compressor?
I think there might be a compressor. You think? So you learn some stuff when you run this on stuff. You run this on some of the stuff you pick up off of the radio. I don't know what to say. It gets rid of the point thing in the middle. I don't know what they're doing. I don't want to know, but it explains why I turned the radio off, too. There's no big peak at zero.
Is that because of DC offset?
No. Well, there was a peak slightly on one side or the other, a zero, that would still be a peak. And there's no peak. It just goes.
And square waves look more like?
Square waves look more like this. The square wave looks like railroad tracks.
So that could be.
If you had this and this and everything else was at the bottom, that would be a square wave.
So it's worse. The radio is worse than that even.
The radio, so I've stuff in the radio that's worse. It looks just like this, except there's no peak here.
That's worse.
Yeah. I wasn't debating you at all on that. And there's a script on the thing. You can do this to any WAV file, so feel free to grab it and try it. You know? I've been giving this script away for a while because I want people to try it. Mm-hmm. Okay, now we get a little bit more complicated. So now what we're going to do is we're going to now talk about how to actually use this to do a live capture of something. Okay, we have this time waveform. Now, the way I generated this time waveform was as a crap load of all pass filters, one forward, one back, one forward, one back. Just keep going until it gets to the right length. And the length of an all pass filter, just using single tap all pass filters, so length 2, 3, 5, 7, basically prime numbers. So this is what you wind up with the spectrum. This little glitch here is because I'm actually truncating the ends a little bit. An all-pass filter, strictly speaking, has an infinite response, so I had to truncate the ends a little bit. But if you look here, you know, the error is total of 0.7 dB peak to peak, and it only happens very near the Nyquist frequency where generally you don't have any data anyhow. But the point is I have this signal, and I have that phase, and this is just a piece of the phase. Notice this is just the first 1,000 samples of a million sample stimulus. And you have to admit that's a pretty wild phase response.
Radians?
That's radians. That's a pretty wild phase response, isn't it? But that's how you get all that spread out. What?
It's rapid.
It's wrapped too, but it's wrapped because it's centered in the middle. But it's both wrapped. But I mean, if you look at this, that's just kind of wild, yeah. And I can play what that sounds like. Hello, give me my cursor. Where's my cursor? Sort of weird. I've come up with a variety of these. This is the third way I've done it. There's an infinite number of ways to make all pass sequences, fortunately, since people persist in patenting them. Yeah?
So the point of this sequence is that it kind of contains all different...
It contains frequencies. All frequencies. And if I analyze this at a length longer than it, it still contains all frequencies. And why that's important will become come out in a minute, and I'll show you in a minute why that's important. But let me go on here. So basically, what this means, this has the same spectrum as an impulse, except it's a lot longer, and therefore it has lots more energy. And basically, this makes hardware happier. Hardware doesn't like impulses, to put it mildly. I see the analog designer going, this increases the energy of the signal, which means if you put this out into a room, you get a better signal-to-noise ratio. And makes it time, you think this makes all this spreading makes the time domain hard to figure out, right? Wrong. Because it has all energy at all frequencies. Well, first let's just show you something here. This is the input to a Butterworth filter and the output from the filter. This is just a standard third order Butterworth. Now, why don't we just do that all the time? Well, that's got an impulse, it's got low energy, it causes hardware to go spastic. You think hardware doesn't, regular electronics don't like impulses? You should put them into a loudspeaker and see what happens. Not good is the best way I can, the nicest thing I can say is just not good. So you really don't want to do this last thing unless you're trying to measure distortion. And I was originally going to talk about how to measure distortion, but I figure I'm going to run out of time without doing it. But pretty obviously, you can take difference in spectra, and you can figure out distortion real fast that way.
Can you contrast that with the white noise, then?
Well, white noise contains all frequencies, but doesn't have a fixed phase pattern. See, this is a fixed stimulus, so it has a fixed phase pattern. Now, if you think about it, if I take that thing and I multiply, you know, when I put it into the room response convolves with that noise, right? Now what happens? I take the transform of that and I divide by the transform of that signal, I back the phase out, don't I? Ah, yes, let me show you. Okay, we take the probe signal and the filtered probe. Okay, now we take the transform of the filtered probe and we divide it by the transform of the probe signal. Hey, that looks like a Butterworth frequency response, doesn't it? And I take the inverse transform of this and I get the impulse response. That great big long stretched out stimulus comes right back to the impulse response that you should have in the first place. You back, basically when you divide by 1 over a number with a modulo of 1, it's reversing the phase. So what I'm doing is I'm deconvolving the signal, I'm backing the phase response out. Now, if you have a signal that has zeros in the frequency domain, you can't do that because you'd be dividing by zero, enough said. Even if it just got a lot smaller and you weren't dividing by zero, that means your noise sensitivity goes through the roof. So you can't do that either. So that's why the structure of the signal is important. You know exactly what the phase is, and you know, white noise doesn't have constant spectrum. This has constant spectrum. This is all frequencies all the time. That's important. That's actually an important consideration.
So if you reverse back out to the impulse function, essentially like you've characterized the room.
Well, at this point, I've characterized the Butterworth filter, but you notice the speaker and the mic. And you notice I have Audacity on here and I can play the sound. So can you guess where we're headed? Okay, now, compared the two, red, there is in fact a red thing under here is the FFT method. The green thing is directly doing it by running the filter on the impulse. This is the difference here. The largest difference in that is 2 times 10 to the minus 13. So that's pretty exact. Would we agree that that's a pretty good result, you know? An error of 2 times, that's what? 260 dB. The error is 260 dB down when you do this. Good enough? But the point is, now you didn't put a signal into the thing that causes it to choke, and you can put that into a loudspeaker, and the loudspeaker won't choke. And, well, it's the convolution. Remember, you multiply, when you convolve things in the time domain, you multiply them in the frequency domain. Lo and behold, when you divide things in the frequency domain, you deconvolve. Thank you. mathematics, when you have the right thing to deconvolve by, mathematics is very useful. If you don't have a signal with the right characteristics, it's going to suck. I mean, it has to be central, because otherwise if you have spill around the edge, you get into all the FFT circularity stuff, which is why I'm saying this is effectively windowed even though there's no window. But when you divide, you deconvolve. So I backed out all that phase shift and you get the answer. Yeah?
It would be more efficient in real time to do your processing through convolution?
Well, the convolution will be n squared, and the FFT is n log n. What do you think?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Next question. And you notice, and I don't know if you noticed the length of that sequence. That sequence is 2 to the 18th, I think, or 2 to the 19th long. So, you know, it's milliseconds versus hours. I count that as a win. Okay? So when you multiply, you can't, you know, doing things in the time domain with zeros makes it hard to deconvolve. And rarely do you deconvolve frequency domain signals anyhow, because among other things, that would mean that you were trying to develop information on signals that were outside of the window. Good luck with that. That's why you can't do it. You're trying to basically do, you know, it's not a simple thing to do. Zeros. Now, if the thing you're trying to deconvolve by has any zeros, like we're deconvolving in the frequency domain, you know, we're dividing the frequency. If the domain you're dividing in has zeros, you're out of luck. Have a nice day. Have a nice life. It ain't going to work. Deconvolution is never exact. If you have zeros, it can't be exact. There's ways to do this. Sometimes life is like that. Like when you're trying to recover signals from the Pioneer that's out in the Oort cloud, yeah, you have to do some serious processing. And you have to pretty much guess at a bunch of the signal, and because the signal is heavily redundant, you can pretty much evaluate whether your guess is any good or not. But for audio, where we have a signal-to-noise ratio that's generally positive instead of, you know, they're dealing with minus 80 dB signal-to-noise ratio and getting an answer. I prefer not to do that if I don't have to.
You don't want to just add some small number to avoid dividing by zero.
No, that's effectively what you do, but now that wrecks your noise sensitivity. It's called condition number. People that have done linear algebra know the term condition number. A big condition number would be 1 over that small number.
Condition. Well, the zero would be ill-conditioned, right?
Yeah, it would be singular. Yes, exactly. Okay, so, where are we? Fast convolution. This is just something to mention with FFT. You know, if you do a convolution in the time domain, it's n squared. If you do the convolution by doing an FFT that's at least of length of the two sequences minus one, you do the transform of one, the transform of the other, multiply them, and then do the inverse transform. So it works actually, that's actually should be 13 log 2 m plus n plus 1, which is a big number, but it's an off, but for most anything over 1k is a whole lot smaller than n squared. Or n times n. Well, convolution certainly can be n times n. But, you know, m plus n, you know, that just is so much smaller. It's
at the 10,000 foot level, it's just intuitively, it seems like more processes would take longer. Not the case.
Well, the window gets to be longer, and it means it does put more strain on your arithmetic resolution. But you know, you can see we're running it. You know, with those 10-second long transforms, we're getting 10 to the minus 13. Yeah, 10 to the minus 13 error, so I'm not going to burst into a big sweat about it. And it means well, I can demonstrate it in real time instead of waiting till tomorrow. So I like that. Okay, the point. By doing transforms, you can do some stuff that would just be a pain in the time domain. And I had planned another break, and wouldn't you know, I'm almost spot on my hour per break. 5 minutes.
Start a bonfire.
Yeah.
I'm better insulated than you are, and I'm cold.
Which is projector.
I was thinking about putting my hand right there.
The problem with those kind of places is they tend to sell just the high-end gear because that's where the money is for them. There's Best Buy, which has Magnolia Hi-Fi things in it, but you have to watch out for the Geek Squad who are goofs. What can I say?
Well, who's doing like the projector stuff? Because I mean, I assume you'd also match up like a reasonable screen with the projector, right? Yeah. You don't just project on the computer.
Actually, you can with the right paint. I'm not a fan of fancy goofball screens. I think the best screen is plain matte black to matte white. And of course, that is the lowest gain. But light is not, unless you're using a CRP and making a pretty good sized picture, light's not going to be your issue in home theater. So people who go for gain eight screens and all this weird shit, they're crazy. That's a holdover from CRTs when all you could get was 150 lumens. So you actually, a painted wall will work if you use the right paint. What you want is pure titanium, absolutely flat white paint, and a smooth wall, not bounce like paint.
Right. Yeah.
In fact, I'm using a screen I built as a temporary thing. I did that 8 years ago. I'm still using it, which is made out of a piece of foam board that I had selected. Cost me $8. There's a place.
Did you just put a piece of paint on? Just
no,
paint?
I didn't.
It's just straight
foam core. But I handpicked it out of the bin. And one side is too shiny. The other side is there's. I can see the hot spot. Nobody else can seem to see it. But it's not. It's so slight it doesn't bother me. And that's what I'm still using. There's a place in down on 4th Avenue South, I think, that sells foam core in 4x8 or even 5x10 sheets. So that's what I'm using. If you want to do acoustically transparent screen, then you've got to buy a real screen. That can run into money.
Yeah.
And that, in many ways, is the way to go, but there's some compromises even at best.
Well, I mean, right now I've got a bunch of speakers.
Those probably wouldn't fit in the kind of screen anyway.
The left and right, of course.
That's the way I have mine set up. So I wouldn't shy away from it to do it yourself. If you've got the money, there's some damn good screens out there. But you can get 90% of it for real cheap if you pick the right stuff.
We don't need any Mozart. Okay, now we're going to talk about something called the analytic envelope. So you notice we can see where that peak in that impulse response came out, but it's really sort of hard to tell where the peak is because it's a time waveform. It has positive and negative swings and so on. So what do you do? Well, we're going to do sort of a dry lab here first, and then we're actually going to measure something. But first we do the dry lab, get the impulse response of a filtered signal, And you see that impulse response you get there? It's kind of hard to tell where the delay of that is, isn't it? I mean, you know, is it, which peak is the biggest? You can, you know, does the peak maybe come between two of the peaks? The real center of the impulse response is hard to tell. Well, what you can do is you first have to remember a couple of things. First, delay is not constant with frequency. That's an 11th order of Butterworth, by the way. So that's why it's so steep. That's why it's so funny looking. It's an 11th order Butterworth. You know, the impulse response confuses the issue of delay. And the fact that it's sampled makes it even harder because the peak could come between samples. So now what? Well, we need a signal and we need the quadrature component. We need the complex component, right? Well, how do we do that? Well, no, I'm not going to explain Hilbert math. Not today. As a matter of fact, if we're going to do that, I'm going to get somebody, you know, get John Hardy to teach it or something. I don't know. Certainly not going to teach it. But there's something called the analytic envelope. If you take away the negative frequencies, you create something called the analytic signal, which has both the real and the imaginary parts of the signal. It sounds strange. It's going to be complex. But after lots of theorems, some of which I only kind of understand, pardon me, you wind up with the complex version of the signal. Basically, it has the quadrature component, so you can measure phase directly if you want to from it. But if you take the absolute value of that, which is to say the real squared plus the square root of the real squared plus the imaginary squared, you get the envelope of the signal. What does it look like this? Well, you just basically throw away the negative half of the frequencies, and then you take the inverse FFT, and then you figure out the absolute value. So now, it's a lot easier to tell where the delay is there, isn't it? You can tell where the peaks are. And what you can tell for this particular filter is that different pieces of the filter have different frequencies, have radically different time delays. You can see, you know, like 30 samples difference in the, you know, different frequencies. That's why there's two peaks. That's what you get when you have a really high order filter too. So, but you ask, okay, why doesn't it start at 100? Well, it doesn't start at 100, which is where the peak went in, because the filter adds delay. So you're seeing the filter delay in addition to where the impulse is. And that second bump, well, I picked a deliberately really steep filter, so you see the results. You see the massive change in time delay with frequency. But this will show you the time delay, the overall time delay. And if you want to limit the frequency, if you want to figure it out inside of a given set of frequencies, you zero everything but the positive part of those frequencies, take the inverse transform, you can get the delay for, and you can get the envelope just for that band of frequencies if you want. That works too, I mean. So you could figure it out, you know, for the lower half and the upper half. In this particular filter, you'd find out there was a big change in delay below about 80% of the passband and above 80% of the passband. Because the phase just goes... Sorry, I saw somebody raising their hand over there.
No, I was going to ask that secondary bump that's due to the phase...
That's due to the fact that it isn't anything like linear phase.
So a Bessel function would...
A Bessel filter would be very much more... Actually, a Bessel filter would give you something very much like a Gaussian. Put it all together. We can calculate the frequency response using these long-term signals. We can calculate the system delays. What do you have when you calculate the frequency response and the system delays, you have a measurement system, right? Let's look at a few things, though, before we run some real stuff. I'm going to take that signal. I'm adding some noise. You can see what I did with that signal is I filtered the probe at 25% of the Nyquist rate with that 11th order filter. Then I added a crap load of noise. The signal-to-noise ratio is minus 32 dB. And can you tell where the time delay is within a few samples? Look at the analytic envelope. That's pretty good, isn't it? So you can see, you can really pull stuff out of the mud this way. In fact, this kind of processing is how they actually do, you know, capture the modems from those things that are flying out of the solar system. very long window processing with very slow changing signals. Okay, this has 0 dB SNR. And that's pretty clean, isn't it? Yeah?
Could you explain again what the delay actually is between the two points?
Well, the pulse went in at 100 here. You notice the biggest peak here is what? Oh, 100 and whatever it is. I can't tell from here. But what it says there's peaks at a few different delays because of the filter characteristic. If the filter goes like this, if you think about it, that's as it goes like this, it's a big delay, but then the delay goes back to close to zero again. So you see undelayed, a little bit delay, heavily delayed, and then a little bit of delay, and that's what you see there.
So the delay for the first big peak is maybe 110?
Well, it'd be, you subtract 100 to get the number of the actual time and samples, because the impulse went in, effectively went in at 100.
Okay.
Yeah. But I mean, it's...
Okay.
Yeah, delay of 10 samples. And if you want to get subsample accuracy, you can use a longer IFFT. And you can get, you can improve your accuracy here. It's a little bit tricky. You have to think about how to do it, but you can do it. But, the synchronous detection works. What happens when you try to measure the frequency response that way? Well, no. This, there's a lot of systems out there that use an arbitrary signal, and it takes them a long time to develop the actual frequency response of the room. And this is the reason why. Because if you want to measure the frequency response of the room, the energy getting to the microphone from your probe had better be substantially bigger. The noise energy in the room at that frequency, or you don't know what you're getting. Now, there are different ways to do this. There's the, I don't remember, they'll talk about systems in the afternoon, I don't remember the names of them, that basically sit there and they capture the times when the signal is strong enough to actually use. They're smart. They figure out how to do that. Or a better way is to just have something that's 10 dB louder than the room. If you don't have a room full of people, you can do that. So if you use a probe signal that doesn't reach a noise level, you won't ever get any information. That's not quite true. If you ran it a million times, you could do some smart averaging, but we'd prefer not to do that. Now, that's basically why the two input analyzers they take time. I mean, you just have to wait until you get a part of the signal that actually gives you the information you need to get. How do they work? Well, they use the music as a probe signal. Basically, they do FFTs, but then they have to look at the coherence of the room signal to the FFT. They have to do a lot more work than the way I'm doing this to work with an arbitrary signal. I guess if you want to use an arbitrary signal, they're the more or less the only thing on the market, the only thing that's going to work, but I like to characterize my stuff in a quiet room. They can't do the deconvolution trick because they don't have control of the signal, of course. Now, we did some stuff in Dan's basement. Now, there's a lot of interesting things on this. First thing we do is we calculate the frequency response of the reference, which is to say just looping the signal back into the DDA, back into the ADD. And it had better look like this, right? And this is 22050. This is now a real frequency scale here. What you see here is you see two frequency responses. You notice one of them looks reasonable and one of them has a whole bunch of zeros in it. Well, what we did here is we held up that piece of plywood behind the mic and got a big whopping reflection. Now if you look at the analytic envelope, the log of the analytic envelope of the probe signal. You see the big spike here at the beginning. And then if you look over here, you can tell pretty much exactly how far away the plywood was. The distance here is 5 what, this is like 3 or whatever milliseconds to about 8 milliseconds or so. And in fact, it was set up to be exactly a 1 meter path, so it's about 7 feet, which is about 7 milliseconds, which is exactly what you'd see. You can actually measure where it was. You can see that reflection. You can see the wood reflecting. You see some interesting things. This is when it was bouncing off the plywood, bouncing off the wall, and then getting back to the mic. This one, I'm not sure where these were, but you can see all these different reflections. So you can actually measure the reflections in a case like this. You notice the magenta one is without plywood, and here the signal gets all the way to the back wall. And there's the back wall. But you don't see that in the cyan thing because there was a big piece of plywood in the road. So you can actually get, you know, some pretty good information by looking at the envelope. You can say, where are my big reflections coming from? What do I really not like about this room? So, worried about smoothing the spectrum. Think about it. You're smoothing the spectrum, you're cutting down on the frequency resolution, right? That means it's equivalent to shorting the analysis length. It's that simple. What we have here is a very high resolution frequency response on one of the on the really spiky version of the thing in Dan's basement. We have here, I have literally filtered the amplitude response of the room by running a filter both ways on it, you know, so I don't have any phase shift. This has 256 line smoothing. This is dividing the length of the analysis by 128. And because of the way the filters work, yes, this is twice this. That's right. That's not a mistake. And you notice that those two amounts of smoothing look whole lot like each other, and that's because we did the same thing two different ways. So that's what smoothing is. Now, in reality, what you really want to do in smoothing in the spectrum is to do the right amount of smoothing so that you do a smoothing roughly based on the frequency response of the ear. And that will get your time delay at different frequencies. I didn't write that script. It's a little bit complicated, but it's not impossible. If somebody's teaching a course, you ought to get your students to write that script. Every one of them. If they can write that script at the end of a class, they understand a fair amount about the ear, a fair amount about time resolution, a fair amount about Fourier transforms. They may not understand all the math, but they understand what's going on. So, well, the factor two, you get the thing. You need different time resolution at different frequencies. You don't get an auditorially germane one unless you vary the bandwidth with smoothing with frequency. What you can do just means you have to use lots of filters and center them at different frequencies, and the overlap can be a little tricky and you have to handle it properly. Again, you'll find out hand windows are very useful. And just use different hand windows. Now some measurements. And now I'm pretty much going to kill the PowerPoint because now we're actually going to go to the real world here. Hello, wake up Toshiba. Did that go to sleep?
No.
I think it was your computer.
My computer's back awake. Can you wake up the projector? I think the projector went to sleep on me.
No, it's still projecting.
I know.
You did it before.
There's no signal which suggests that your external output has turned itself off.
What's that, F9?
No. I don't. Let's see. No, it doesn't look like it's turned itself off. Let's see. It thinks it's sending it.
Still plugged in?
Yeah. I think it timed out. Well, here. Let's see. Let's do a. Let's give it a shock here. Did that? Oh, I don't know what's going on, but we seem to have lost the projector connection completely. And my laptop still thinks it's running.
Can you manually select?
I just did that.
Hit input and see if that cycle through.
It still thinks it's connected here.
How about if you turn it off and back on again?
There we go. Okay. It decided that its input was shut off, I think, and it was shutting itself off for us. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is bring up Audacity, which should come up over here in a second. Hello. Wake up. There we go. Okay, now what I'm going to do is I'm going to play this, and I'm going to record the output. And you're going to see two waveforms. I'm not doing it yet. You're going to see two waveforms. One is going to be the direct loop back, and one is going to be the mic capture. So now, ask for at least moderate quiet now. Hello. This file name. Yeah?
Before you close that, would you do the just select from the middle and do the analyze thing and show the graph?
Okay. I have never done that, but I will try.
Yeah, so just select a few seconds and go up to the analyze menu. Plot spectrum.
Click. Oh.
It might be on the other screen.
Yeah, it appears over here. So you can get a spectral analysis of some sort. And it calls it Hanning. Hiss.
Mm-hmm.
hiss.
A lot of people get that wrong.
Anyhow, you can do different resolutions and so on there. And now I'm not going to save that because I already saved the file. And now I'm going to go over here and grab my octave thing again. And now we notice we have this file foo, and I have a file called, and I have this thing called crunch, which is going to read in the original probe signal, read in the captured file, do all that deconvolution stuff. You've got the thing. I'm not going to go through it. It'd take an hour. But you've got it on the website. Go through it. And it will think for a while. And then we have, again, this comes out in the wrong window. I'm glad we did it when we did it. Now what you see in the top one is, again, the loop back. It's what you would expect to see in the loop back. You see the room capture. And you see time delay. You see the floor reflection there. What is it? That's like 3 feet to like 14 feet. So there's like an 11-foot path there. You can see the reflections. You'd see more reflections on downstream if we plotted them, but we didn't. Anyhow, now you see the speaker and plus room response. Now we're going to do the capture again. But now somebody's going to hold the plywood up behind the mic. Meanwhile, back at the ranch.
You need to wait till the noise stops?
What? Behind the mic. But don't bother holding it up yet. I just get it right centered on the mic and close, but don't bother holding it up yet because we can't hear what we're doing yet. And besides, I have to do one other thing. I have to move I have to rename that file. In the classic Unix,
CP bar.
I'm going to move foo to bar, and I'm going to calculate a new foo. So now bar is now a reference without the ugliness. And
the top spectrum.
Yeah, that's the loopback.
That was your reference.
But now we're going to use the whole thing, including the captured room,
gotcha,
as a reference. We're going to plot two sets of delays. We'll be able to see the delay on this, even if we can't see the. Let me find out how loud that is. Oh, it's okay. We won't get a good frequency response, but we can capture the delay with it. Or do we want to wait? What do you think?
Well, I don't know.
You have to do things.
Yeah. Noise. Okay. So
you're also blocking it out with that thing, right?
Hold it up. All about here, right behind it. Yeah. Much closer. Much closer. Okay. There. And a little higher if you can. Yeah. Okay. And starting to record. And see, there's another script called Crunch 3. The reason it's named Crunch 3 is because it takes in three files instead of two, because it has to take the reference and the old reference. It has to take the old capture, the new capture, and the reference. And we run that, and it thinks, and we have lots here. Wow. That worked, Rick. Can anybody tell where the plywood was?
Yeah.
Even with all that hideous racket, it's not too hard to see where the plywood was, was it?
It's the brown, right?
What?
Was that the brown?
That's the
magenta.
The magenta.
Oh, way, number 12? Oh, number 6, 7. There you go.
Let's see, where's that? Where's the, here it is. Right here is and this is still the ground. The ground didn't move, and because of the way you held it up, you didn't block the ground thing. So you can see this. You can see it really didn't improve the frequency response too much, did it?
So what if he moves backwards while it's doing that?
You'll see a spread out peak.
Right?
What? Yeah.
It'll be wide, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the first peak is the delay of.
No,
that's the original.
This is the original.
Zero was the loopback.
Right.
Yeah. So then there, that represents the delay to that distance. So then the peak for the plywood, does that represent the round trip distance?
That's
bounce off the plywood and come back.
Well, this time would be the time from the speaker to the plywood and then back
to the mic.
So that was this distance. And you see the floor down here. And there are some interesting things, like if I go and...
Well, there's a wall behind
close
that.
Close this a second. Take a look here. I'm willing to bet that if you measure that in feet, you're going to come out around, 2.66 feet. Looks a little longer than that, but... that was in the noise, so...
JJ, what about that wall, that other piece of wood over there?
That isn't showing. Well, I think that's out.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's more. I think the round trip's more than 20 feet.
Distance between is about two and a half.
Two and a half? Well, about, see, this is what happens if you calculate it based on the speed of sound. So there we just measured how far
speed
our
of sound is a little, well,
what?
A little slower. It's colder.
Yes, colder, but the point is we just measured this distance.
1,000 feet per second.
Well, 1153. I have it for 70F, and it's not 70F in here. Okay. And now we need to move a little bit of hardware around. There is an incredibly ghastly live hallway in the back, and while Bob does the patching, I'll explain what we're doing. We've done this in a room that's not too bad. I mean, this isn't a great room, but it's not horrible. But now there's a hallway in the back that you can walk through during lunch. You heard it. Which we would have to describe as kind of live.
Reverb chamber?
Reverb chamber.
What do you mean? It's actually, it's short period reverb. So it's very, it's got about a couple second hang time, but it's short period, so you don't really hear a reverb. It's more just nasty flutter echo.
I've heard some great stairwells.
Well, this is a hallway. Okay.
Should be live.
Okay. Well, we will find out. Apart this. Go over here.
East board is better best. North board eastbound.
Let's see if we. Looks like we have a mic there. Yes, we have a mic. Good.
3 seconds. No.
So now, well, you won't be able to hear this test, but we will start it. See it already, can't you? Now I'm going to put this into export into the infamous spoo. Yeah. Go over here, make that go away. And put this away. No. And go back over here and bring up octave, or octave, come in octave. And now we're going to say crunch. Now we didn't, not doing crunch 3, we don't have a reference here, we're just doing one called crunch. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is pretty.
Look at all those, that's rich.
Wide.
What? Now, what I really need to do is I really need to replot that last one on a longer scale, don't I?
I see two or three prominent peaks.
Yeah. And, well, and then... Well,
and then after that, it's fade out, right?
Well, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to show you one of the advantages of being able to program this.
Now, what if you would have left it go longer? Oh, I guess it wouldn't have.
Is the mic about 15 feet from the speaker box?
Yeah.
Yeah.
About 16 feet from the looks of it.
Yeah.
You want to go back and check?
Sure.
I would be... This process tends to be pretty reliable. If you have a 20 dB signal to noise ratio in the room, you can get to about a half a sample resolution. So, you know, that's...
What if you would have left it go longer? Would it have faded?
Well, it's not a question of letting it go longer. The plot is what's cut off here. And what I was about to do was... And I will bring this over here and show it. Let me close this, get out of the road. Okay, see, what we do here is we're only plotting part of it, you see. And then what I'm going to do here is I'm going to put in here, I'm going to say PLEN, I don't know, it helps if I type right. P, what's going on here? PLM equals, well, let's make it 4,000 now, okay? I'm going to go down here.
The answer is 17.25.
Mm-hmm. Pretty close.
Yeah.
Now, if I did that right, I should have a bigger, longer tail here. I'm just changing the length I'm plotting of that.
And this is crunch 3.
This is crunch 3, which is now about to become... What? Yeah. Good, no error messages. Yeah. And over here we have onward, ever onward. And I'll point out that's 20 dB there. That's that 1.5 would be 30 dB, so sorry, it would be 60 dB because it's amplitude. So what? 1.5 minus 1.5 would be 60. So I'll point out, 100 feet later, we're still just hanging on like nobody's business. And you can also tell that frequency response would be described as what?
Rich.
What?
Rich.
Busy.
Not nice, maybe.
Beaver.
What?
Like a beaver.
Yeah. So that shows you the kind of things that you can pull off, running some simple scripts in Octave. And it is 11:44, so now I can do some questions until noon, and we go eat.
What can you tell about the very small time? What can you tell about the very small time intervals there?
What do you mean, small?
In between the little peaks. Anything there? Any information there?
Well, what it's telling you is the room is specular as hell, is what it's telling you. But we knew that. If you want to know where it is, you can follow the wire in there and go find out where it was played. Yeah?
Could you explain how you're playing the sound file and recording?
I'm just playing it out of Windows Media Player.
Okay, so you're just...
I'm just running a PCM file out of Windows Media Player. Okay.
Sound card.
You don't need to. How do you know when the? Maybe I'm just not thinking about this in a smart way. How do you know when the zero peak is, if you're not timing?
Well, because what I'm doing is I'm taking the loop back, and I'm using the loop back to find the zero peak. Okay. And well, hold on. I can show you how that works. Well, if you take a look here. You'll see here, I find the peak and I find the position of the peak. And the difference in the position of the two peaks is the sample difference divided by the sampling rate, multiply it by the speed of sound, and that's how many feet away it is. And that's what I did. And that's how it came out to, an eighth of an inch here or something. Actually, I didn't look at the distance for that one. What does it say? Okay, it's claiming 16.001 feet. 17.25. Is it really cold in that room?
Yeah, cold.
Okay.
It's wintertime.
Yeah. That's one of the things about the speed of sound. It's only approximately a constant.
Density, temperature.
Well, temperature, humidity. Well, that's one of my other lectures, air isn't linear. Yeah?
Are your scripts on the deck at the AE
desk? Scripts are on the...
You mentioned something about Photo Bucket.
Photo Bucket has some pictures. Well, you know what?
I didn't get the address for that.
Hold on. Oh, be that way. Freeware strikes, but you know what? It's hard to beat the price. Now let me do something here. Presto. Somewhere down here we will see it, and I will call. Wait, is that the right one or is? Yeah, no, that's the wrong one. This is the stuff I keep around to condense audio files. So, no, it doesn't work that way. Where is it? Where is, oh, level histogram, do you think that might be it? Okay, and you can see all sorts of different level histograms. This one's well recorded. Notice, no clipping. Nice. And it's, you know that song, right? Mm-hmm. Now it's turned, what?
Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, well recorded.
It was done in analog, wasn't it?
Originally, yeah.
1968.
Yep. What's this? This is Velvet Green by Jethro Tull.
Missing codes.
Where's the bite me button on that? Okay, we have here on the other hand VIU. What'd you say there? Oops.
VIU?
VIU.
That's the name of the song?
That's... you'll have to ask my daughter. She gave it to me. But that's... Do you detect any overload? You know, and there's a variety of things. So, you know, I put these up because I was having a debate with somebody who was insisting that, no, they really weren't that bad.
Hmm.
Yeah?
How come those two overloads weren't symmetrical, left and right?
Ask the guy that made it.
It's not automatically symmetrical.
Don't ask me, man.
Okay.
There are some compressors that compress at the waveform level asymmetrically, deliberately. That's
here we go. This is,
on AM,
you know, Avril Lavigne isn't even so bad. But then again, that's what, 95 or 99, not 2010? Anything I picked up that was made this year has those nasty railroad tracks.
How did they get those missing codes towards the end? How does that happen?
Well, because you will see some of that if you only have a few things getting close to overload, which makes sense. You would expect to see a few.
Oh, okay, great.
And then we have this.
This is how much time it's spending.
I upset a couple of people because I named names here, but too bad. This one I can almost accept. It's supposed to be punk, you know? But it sure is. So there, you know, I have a whole bunch up here. You can go there and look anytime you want. I don't think they'll be going anywhere.
Have you actually settled any debates with those guys?
Well, a couple of people have said, oh. I mean, that's literally a quote. Oh, and then there's some things here. You know, why you don't do digital clipping? Spectrum, sine wave, spectrum of the sine wave. Digitally clipped sine wave. Don't you love that spectrum? Yes, sirree. A few aliases of those harmonics, would you say? This is why you don't do digital clipping. And why it sounds like something I'm not probably shouldn't say in public.
So if I take a detect clipping and then at that time round it,
yeah.
Non-real time.
And you've heard these people argue that you see beating and there's beating in digital samples and you can't get full response close to this Nyquist rate because they see the bottom blue thing coming out of their CD, their DDA. Well, see, that is the fundamental up there, plus all the aliases. Everything except the top sine wave is above half the sampling rate. So if you filter that bottom thing out, you get the top one. Now, there are people who still insist that that has to be wrong because they don't wish to believe it, but what can you do? Anyhow, that's all there. This is my neck. And you're welcome to see them, upload them, beat people over the head with them, flog them with them if you can, please.
We'll let you know how that goes, too.
Yeah, right. Well, it depends on who they are. So I think at this point we have hit lunchtime.